Hey, everybody. Glad you could be with us this week. Before we get to my guest, February 23rd and 24th, I'm headlining in New York City at Gotham Comedy Club. So if you live in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Alaska, come to New York. February 23rd, 24th, Friday and Saturday, I'm at Gotham Comedy Club on 23rd Street. You can go to GothamComedy.com and you get tickets. Really great time. I'm there like once a year. So come on by, hang out. We've got five shows. It's going to be great. Second thing, just stop screwing up brownies. These people that put, like, you know, nuts in them and then swirls of peanut butter and cherry flavor, or they make it with that fancy dark chocolate that the French ate before the revolution. Just some basic brownies, okay? Just Duncan Hines, okay? Make it simple. That and meatballs. Stop putting a lot of stuff in meatballs. I may have talked about this before, but it's really, really irritating me. Here's the ingredients for meatballs. Meat, and then a little salt and pepper, maybe a little garlic, egg and breadcrumb if you want to give it some density. But just your meat. Fry it up, put it in the gravy. Italians, we call it gravy, not sauce. And then you eat it. Then you have a brownie for dessert that you didn't screw up, okay? My guest this week, Phil Rosenthal, creator of a little show you might have heard of called Everybody Loves Raymond, Emmy Award-winning writer, creator, hilarious guy. He's got a new show out on Netflix. It's a food travel show. He goes all over the world checking out food and all these really cool places like Saigon, Bangkok. It's called Somebody Feed Phil. It's out on Netflix. You got to watch it. He's really, really funny in it. And you see some really cool places. And you watch it, you get hungry. And then you eat meatballs and brownies. All right? And we talk about how we created Raymond and what it was like to work with Ray Romano and running a show. And, you know, we talk about great comedians throughout history. Just a really cool conversation. It goes in a lot of different directions, which are my favorite ones. So enjoy, Phil, and come see me February 23rd and 24th at Gotham Comedy Club. Hey, folks. Welcome to the show. On with me today, a great, great, very, very funny man who is currently hosting his own show on Netflix called Somebody Feed Phil. Also the creator and co-creator and showrunner of Everybody Loves Raymond, Phil Rosenthal. Hey, Phil, how you doing, buddy?
It's nice to talk to you, Paul. I'm such a fan.
Oh, thank you. Same here. I love the idea of this show that you're doing right now. You are traveling to places in season one like Saigon, Lisbon, Bangkok, Tel Aviv, Mexico City, New Orleans, checking out food, but also it's about people. And we were just talking off air a little bit about that. And just touch on, because what I watched, it was the food was interesting, but your interaction with the people was as much, if not more, interesting.
Here's what I think, that food is the great connector and laughs are the cement. Hmm. And so I believe that the food and hopefully the humor is the way to get you, the guy on the couch, mm-hmm. to travel.
Yeah.
Because I think the world would actually be a little better if we all experienced a bit of someone else's experience, right?
Right.
So I just am trying everything I can to get you to have what I have, which is this amazing relationship with travel. I love it so much, and I've loved it. I never went anywhere as a kid, mm-hmm. but in my early 20s, that first trip for nothing, well, I think I was a courier for DHL. DHL, when they started, you could go, if they'd buy you a coach ticket to Europe, some city in Europe, didn't know which one,
uh-huh.
and they would give you these luggage tags. Well, the luggage tags, there would be like 30 of them, was how they were shipping their stuff as a passenger's excess baggage. So they needed people.
Wow. I had no idea. Wow.
Early 80s. And so I did this and it blew my mind.
Yeah.
They didn't pay anything, but I stayed in hostels and I stayed with friends of friends on couches and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Telling you, take it from a guy who had no money.
Mm-hmm.
It was still the best experience of my life.
And did you, were you always itching, you know, you're a kid from, you know, the East Coast. Were you always itching to kind of get out and see the world? Was this, you were born in Queens. You went to school here. You went to Hofstra. Like you were planted in New York. A lot of times people get sort of, they're comfortable where they are, but were you always itching to see the world?
Well, I had never been on a plane until I was 9 years old. We went to a bar mitzvah in Atlanta, Georgia, and I thought that was amazing.
That's awesome.
You just want anything different, you know?
Yeah. See, that's when it paid off to be Jewish, too, because you went to a bar mitzvah. If you hadn't been Jewish, you might not have gone on a plane at nine. You never know, right? It would have been taking longer, maybe.
That's right. You know what? You found the one thing that makes it worthwhile.
To be a Jew. Yes.
So we love that. Mm-hmm. I swear to God, Paul, you're going to think I'm making this up, but it was the first time I'd been to a 7-Eleven, and I fell in love with slushy.
When you were nine on that same trip?
Yes.
Oh, that's too funny.
So there's your first taste of exotic, of something other than what you get in New York. And I swear, I'll never forget it.
Oh, that's too much. You're too much.
Then when you were 12.
Right.
Still, never going anywhere. Mm-hmm. Just that weekend bar mitzvah that changed my life.
Right.
But we got an uncle had a condo he wasn't using for a week in Miami Beach. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, if it was cheap, if we could do it. Mm-hmm. So we went to Florida. And this was 1972, around the time that they were about to open this new thing called Disney World in Orlando, Florida. And wow. I begged my parents, can we stop there? Can we stop there? No, no, no. I wore them down. We were going to have one day in Disney World. Disney World in 1972 opened its doors. The part that's the Magic Kingdom wasn't even built all the way yet. Wow. They didn't even have Pirates of the Caribbean yet.
Wow.
That was all there was. There was no Epcot. There was no other land. There was nothing. It was the very bare bones. But as soon as they could open, they could open. I turned to my mother. She said, do you like this? And I said, this is the best day of my life. And she said, oh, come on. She couldn't believe that anyone would think this amusement park. But when you think about it, think about when you were a kid and the first time you went to Disneyland, Disney World.
Yeah.
It actually, I think what they do for kids is awaken a spirit of travel.
I never thought of that. Yeah,
I never thought of it either.
You really do. But it really does put you in that environment.
Well, look, Venice, Italy, is the It's a Small World ride, except everybody waving is Italian.
Exactly. I've been to Venice on my honeymoon, and I never thought of it that way, but you're absolutely right.
I love it so much. It's just everything. I went on in Bangkok now. I go on in the floating market. Huh. Disney's got nothing on the real thing.
Yeah.
You're in a little boat. Yeah. The guy's on the back of the boat, putt-putt motor, going up the little river.
All right.
And on both sides of the river are other people in their boats, and they're selling food.
Right.
And not only selling food like produce, like you could bring home, like do your shopping this way.
Right.
But there's stoves on the boat, and they're making pad thai noodles. And it's not just pretty good for being on a boat. The best pad thai you ever had in your life.
Right. It beats the crap out of the guy in New York City who's standing on hard ground in a kitchen, huh?
Yes. Yes. These moments in your life, you can't believe you're there.
Right.
And you'll never, ever forget them. They're worth every penny that you spend to get there. They're worth spending. I tell people, any spare money you have in your life should be for travel.
Well, you know, it's funny because we were hitting on the current culture and how divisive the political environment is in this country right now, and how
I didn't
know. Everybody's getting along great, and nobody wants to consider the other side's opinion. You know, like I go on these different cable news shows as a commentator, and if you don't toe the line with the person across the desk from you, then they don't agree with you on anything, and you're on opposite sides, and you can't come to any kind of agreement on anything. And so I think what's great about the show, which I think you were touching on, was sort of it's a way to convey that we should sort of look outside of ourselves, beyond our comfort zone, and embrace other people, other cultures, especially now, given who's president and the tone of the country is right now.
I will not sit here and have you denigrate the
great.
I think we don't just have alt-right and alt-left anymore. I think we have alt-universe.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right.
I don't even understand. I really don't. My show is just about a guy going out trying to meet nice people. That's it.
Yeah.
And to show you the value in that. Mm-hmm. This was not supposed to be political. All of a sudden, the embracing of other people from other places is a political statement. Right. What happened to just being nice, just be a human being? And not only that, not for being nice sake, but because you benefit from it.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
You get so much when you do that. You get nothing if you're negative. You took improv, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You guys, you're the improv kings.
Mm-hmm.
What's the number one rule of improv?
Never say no. Always say yes. Yes and. Yes and.
Yes and.
Mm-hmm.
Took the Groundlings, and it was the best class I ever took in anything because yes and is a philosophy of life.
Right, but we're creating a culture of fear. You know, it's like you're not like me. You don't look like me. You don't have the same religion. So I'm in my circle, and I don't want you to be in my circle, and I don't want to be in your circle. And we're becoming more and more isolated from each other. So I think it's great that this is an offshoot of your show. How are they reacting in these other countries? They know you're an American and Trump is your president. What do they think of him? What do they think of us now? Is there any? Has that come through?
Great question to ask. I tell you something. I thought I would either be derided. I thought I would be, scorned even. They feel, and because the world is now connected so much through the internet, they're getting the same exact news that we get, right?
Right.
CNN International. You get everything that's the same. Everybody has the phone. Everybody gets the alerts. It's all the same.
Right.
And I'll tell you something. We think of America as the center of the world, and so does the rest of the world. So they feel like they're just passengers on the boat going down like us. They don't feel different. And if anything, they're a little more frightened because Russia's closer to them.
Right.
They count on us to not facilitate Russia, but to keep it in check.
Yeah, yeah. And do they think we're a joke? Are they just genuinely afraid?
No. When Bush was president, right?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody said anything during the first term, Bush's first term.
Because you had this show in a different.
It's almost like everybody makes mistakes.
Right.
But the second time.
Right.
What's with you guys?
Really?
Like what's wrong? But now they're just scared.
Yeah.
I think Bush softened the ground a little bit.
Right.
But here's the lesson of George Bush. It can always be worse.
If you were running a third term, that would be a great bumper sticker. It can always be worse. Oh, that's too funny.
Always be worse. It's a little bit Jewish, that philosophy, but we understand it.
Yeah.
Everybody understands it.
Did you, this show had a previous incarnation on PBS. And was this something, and you've done other things since Raymond, and obviously Raymond was huge. Did you always sort of have this in the back of your mind? Because you look at food as art. You've invested, I don't know if this number is still accurate, but from what I've read, in 20 restaurants, and one of them might be in Providence, Rhode Island, which is my hometown, which is a great food town.
Oh, I would think. There's a restaurant called Providence. It's in LA.
Oh, it's in LA. Sorry. Okay. I misread that.
The chef is from Providence.
Right.
I'm in over 20 restaurants. The main reason that I invest in restaurants is that I'm not very bright.
Yeah. They're a lousy investment, but you're passionate about food.
I think it's an art form. I think it's as valid an art form as painting or sculpture or music or dance or anything other. And we support all that too. We love it. We love the arts. We support the arts. The arts, I always say, a lot of people think they're disposable when in fact it's the answer.
Right. Right. Well, again, we have an administration that if they could do away with all the funding for the art. Who needs art? You know what I mean?
Well, their heart's in the right place.
Yeah. All we need are giant portraits of Donald Trump everywhere. That's the only art we need. That's all we need. You know, the rest of it, just burn
it. People see that this is closer to communist country than anything.
Oh God, the language. They had Stephen Miller on. CNN did a sort of a little bit of a retrospective on him, like a 10-minute piece. And there's that quote back just when Trump was elected, and he said the question, the desires and the beliefs of the president will not be questioned. That was the line that told me we're in a whole other universe with these guys. And if they can shut everything down and control it like a dictator, they would.
Yeah. And you got Eva Braun as the press secretary. I mean, it's
I never thought of that. It's exactly right. It's like, well, they put pearls on her now. So they're trying to, you know, make her a little more classy. Now I remember you just from afar, and I mean, don't mean this as disrespectfully. You were kind of heavier than you are now at one time, and you lost weight, right? Like I kind of remember seeing you early on when you were
insult all the guests.
Exactly. And
yes, it's true. You know why? I was on the writer's room diet.
Yeah.
This happened to you.
Yes.
You get a dream job working in Hollywood,
yes,
and you sit in a room, and the only sunshine coming in that room all day is the menu.
Yeah. And it's usually you're so tired that you want to want to satiate yourself with something good and gross and gooey and whatever. And it's not same thing. I've been in the writer's room and it's the same thing day after day, night after night. And then there's all this stuff to pick on: M&Ms, peanut M&Ms, cookies. Oh. So it's not a marathoner's diet, that's for sure.
Oh, my God. You'll die if you keep – I mean, we actually started bringing in a nutritionist because it was reaching epidemic levels.
How much of your preparation is involved in terms of going to these countries? How are you deciding where you're going? And then when you get to a country or a city, how do you decide where in that city you're going to go to?
I have a production company that I use. They're the same people that do Anthony Bourdain's show. So it was smart to pick them because they have boots on the ground.
Yeah.
They have people in every city, any place you want to go, they know somebody.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They probably help Bourdain eat what he eats.
Right.
I'm not looking to be that. You know, the way I pitched the show was, I'm exactly like Anthony Bourdain if he was afraid of everything.
Yeah, I saw that quote. I loved it.
That's me. And so I'm using them, and sometimes I'm saying, oh, he went there, I'm not going there.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. And sometimes I do want to go there, but we'll have a different take on it.
Right.
And then the other thing I do is something that everyone can do. We're all now born with the device in our pockets to search. We have the World Book Encyclopedia in our pockets, and it's updated every 2 minutes.
Yeah.
So if you want to know the best restaurants in Lisbon, there they are.
Right.
And if you cross-reference, you suddenly have a place that maybe you want to check out. And then when you get there, you leave room in the schedule for serendipity. You leave room for a local to say, that's not where you go. Let me show you the new thing. This is where you go.
You're at the cart on the street, and you're eating it, and people are walking by, and you're going, this is good over here. You're like, and they just keep walking by you. It was
because I'm an idiot. I'm trying to sell tacos to Mexicans.
Pasty.
They like had tacos before.
It's like,
you know that?
Yeah, yeah. Who's this pasty white Jewish guy telling me to eat my own food? Shut the fuck up, buddy.
It's good. Yes, I'm a moron. I'm sorry. But to me, now listen, I'm in LA now.
Yeah.
And I get really good tacos. Really good.
Yeah.
Not even half as good as when you go to Mexico City.
Do you find that the key to that? I'm Italian, and you know, Italy, the same thing. And my mother and grandmother, like, simple is better, right? Like, not a lot of ingredients. Keep it simple. Yep. Keep it light. And is that the same case in all of these cities and countries that you've been? That they don't kind of muck it up, maybe the way we do here. Our American version of things tends to be a little bit more, you know, souped up or mucked up.
I think I'm gonna teach you a word now. Ungapach.
Ungapach? Okay.
Ungapach.
Unga. Like you're going to say, like I'm passing a stone? Okay. All right.
That means too much stuff on it. Too much stuff going on.
What is the derivation? What country is that?
If you're decorating a house, if you have a dish of food, it's too ungapach. There's too much stuff. Clear away half the stuff, and we'll talk.
Less ungapach. Right? Less.
It's too ungapach. We say it's ungapach.
What country is that? What is the language?
I'm going to say that's the country of Yid.
Yid.
And I'm speaking Yiddish.
Ah, okay, got it. Got it.
Isn't that a great word?
It is a great word. It sums it up.
It applies to so many things.
Like I say to my wife, you know, how do you screw up a meatball? It's hard to get like a good basic meatball. Like people put this in it and that in it and whatever. And then there's like curry and then there's that and whatever. And it's just, it doesn't need to be that complicated. And then I get agitated. It's like, how do you screw up a meatball? What have you come to learn? What surprises have you had in this that you didn't expect, either in the travel, the people that you've experienced, the food, the way the food is prepared, any of those areas?
I'll give you one right close to you, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not first to discover this. I think that Ed Levine and the New York Times discovered this a few months ago, but I was shocked because the best pizza in New York is in New Jersey. It's called Raza's. And I know that's insulting that New Jersey has one over on us, but the champion is this place Raza's in New Jersey. Telling you,
really,
you just get over there. And you made me think of it when you said meatballs, because the guy makes the best meatballs I ever had.
R-O-Z, Raz, like Raz.
R-A-R-A-Z-Z-A. The guy's name is Dan Ricker. He's a friggin' genius, this guy. He makes pizza like he's making, I don't know, like it is rocket science.
It is. Yeah.
I'm telling you.
All right, I'm going to go. I'm going to check it out.
It's 7 minutes on the PATH train. It counts as New York. I'm sorry.
All right, I'm going to go. Places,
you can't even get across town in 7 minutes.
Well, I grew up in Rhode Island, so I'm a Rhode. Yeah. When it comes to pizza and Italian food, it's all about Providence for me. I mean, even though I've lived in New York for a while now, but and New York's got some good pizza, don't get me wrong. But
what do you have in Rhode Island? Al Forno, is that the name?
Well, Al Forno is a great restaurant, but the places we have is Caserta's Pizza is really good. And Catanzano's out of Cranston, but they're also in Providence. Those two are really good. And then there's a third one called Di Petrillo's. Those are the three that are really good. Caserta's is, some people really like Caserta's. I'm less so about Caserta's. I think it's got too much ungapach. Did I get that right? Ungapach?
I'm going to make you honorary Yiddish.
All right, there we go. And what the difference is this whole see, I like a little crust with my pizza. So the problem I've always had is I don't – like if I get a New York slice, I don't eat the first half or third. I want to get to the part where it starts to get thicker and then builds to an actual crust. So I usually like just give that part to my wife or my kid and let him eat the cheese. It's all just cheese and sauce to me. And then but so I'm used to like my grandmother's pizza, and I make pizza too with my son. And I put a crust to it, not a Sicilian crust that it, or a deep dish Chicago, but like, you know, a good half an inch of crust. So when you hold it up, it shouldn't bend down. It shouldn't be like a divining rod. Okay. For anybody listening out there.
Well, the official term is flop. You don't want the flop.
You don't want the flop. There you go. You don't want the flop in bed. You don't want the flop when you eat your pizza. You don't want any flop if you're a guy in your life.
It's all show business.
Exactly. You know, speaking of which, you in sort of researching and reading about you remind me of Gilbert Gottfried in this sense. He was a TV addict too. I think you call self-professed TV addict, and you love TV. You loved Art Carney. You wanted to be Art Carney. And then you went to saw Sid Caesar. You saw tapes of Sid Caesar's show of shows, and you wanted to be Sid Caesar. This is all when you're 12, 13, 14, 15, 16 years old. What was it for Gilbert? You might find this interesting. He lived in a Brooklyn apartment above his father's hardware store. They didn't have a big apartment. So his bedroom was the living room. So at night he couldn't sleep and he was afraid of the dark. So he turned the TV on and he fell in love with Bela Lugosi and all these shows and comedy and everything else. What was it about TV that sort of sucked you in like that?
It was safer than going outside.
Were you being threatened?
Inside, they would punch me. If I stayed inside, they would make me laugh.
Yeah, but you might have been like me. I wasn't like a tough guy either, but I got my laughs kept me out of trouble. Like I would joke and I'd be the funny guy, and that kept me out of trouble a little bit. Some of the guys like
I had to learn how to do that, so I watched TV.
Oh, that's too funny. Oh God. And what was it about Art Carney?
Everyone who made me laugh, I loved. Yeah. Every single – they say, well, who are your influences? I guess I could name 100.
Yeah.
But really, anyone who went for a laugh even, I loved them.
Right, right.
You know, I'm the child of German immigrants, right, who one escaped right after Kristallnacht, my father, and one didn't escape. Mm. My mother was in a camp. So it was not as funny as my parents are, and they are hilarious. It was also – you know, bipolar. It was yelling and horrible. And hey, can I have a bike? All the other kids have a bike. You know what I got when I was your age?
Right. Right.
I can't. Yeah. I didn't really want to hear that. So I put on the Honeymooners.
Oh, wow. Yeah, right. It all goes back to something. There's a tie. There's always a tie in your childhood. There's always. And that escape just kind of, it just took the weight of all that off your shoulders, I'd imagine.
I was laughing, and I found that if I could imitate the Honeymooners, that was the one I loved. Mm. If I could do Art Carney, if I could do Jackie Gleason, when my parents had guests over, for they called it, did your parents call it this? We're having company.
Yes. Yeah. I tell you, the Jews and Italians are exactly the same. I think it's a same.
Absolutely.
A lot of my close friends are Jewish.
Solve food and the mother never leaves you alone.
Right. And there's a lot of high pitched yelling. My wife is a WASP. Okay. So for those of you listening, that's like, you know, somebody that's whose distant relatives came over on the Mayflower or whatever. So she came to my house. We started dating in high school. So I took her to a Sunday Italian family dinner, uncles, aunts, cousins. Okay. 20, 25. We leave and she goes, why was everybody so mad at each other?
We're just talking.
Hey, we're just talking. They were yelling. No, that's we were
right. No, that's us talking.
Yeah. It's exactly the same thing. So when you're watching these things,
yeah.
Do you think that I know you initially once you started thinking about a career, thought about acting, but at this age of 12, 13, 14, a kid, what are you thinking? I want to be in that box. I want to be on TV, or I just enjoy this and love it for it. Or where was your head at that point?
I don't know if you're like me. I didn't know there was writing, directing, producing, editing. I didn't know.
I didn't either.
Just saw my friends on the TV being hilarious, and I wanted part of that. I wanted to be that.
Yeah.
I heard people laughing at them. It sounded like approval to me.
Yeah.
And then if I imitated them to my parents and their company, I could stay up a little later and have cake.
I would imitate. I'd watch Rodney on The Tonight Show or whoever was on, and then I'd go in and I'd do it in the locker room during the lunch break, and all the kids were just falling over laughing. You're exactly like me. Same feeling. Exactly.
Yes, and Monty Python came on when I was in junior high. We thought we were so cool because we were watching that Monty Python came on public television.
Mm-hmm.
It was like nobody watched public television.
Yeah.
But it was the hippest, coolest thing, believe it or not. Mm. That public television at that time, didn't get cooler than that, than Monty Python.
Yeah, I know. I remember watching that in my friend Peter Sherlock's basement. He and I and a couple of other my close friends, and we were in tears, and it was something you never had seen before, which is hard to say about comedy. You know, like it's
yes, love.
Now you said your
immigration from the. Well, I bet you also graduated from Mad Magazine to National Lampoon Magazine, right?
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah, absolutely. It's like
it's the same world.
Yeah.
We're the comedy nerds who loved it so much. I went to bed listening to comedy albums.
Yeah. I can't answer this question ever. Who's your favorite comedian? I go, I like different comedians for different reasons. I think, you know, Jonathan Winters' improv is brilliant. And, you know, obviously Robin Williams is a disciple of his. I mean, you know, Richard Pryor for his personal just honesty. Carlin for just, you know, Carlin I love because he could be really intense and serious, but then do a great fart joke, you know, that he was just a pure comedian. So I just love the art form like you, and I appreciate how hard it is. So, and I love character work and all of that stuff. I just think it's, I don't know. I agree with you. It's like food, you know, it's an art. It's definitely an art and not everybody can do it either, you know?
I didn't have the writing chops at the time. Mm. Or the courage to be a stand-up comedian. Mm-hmm. I think I tried it one night when I was 19, and it scared the hell out of me.
Oh, really?
But I felt if I could become a character, then I enjoyed it. And my favorite was Walter Matthau. Still my all-time favorite.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Love. I mean, just I don't know how old your audience is for this, but maybe some of you haven't heard of this man. Go look at the Sunshine Boys and the Fortune Cookie and the Odd Couple. Mm. You'll see a face that you'll fall instantly in love with. It's like a basset hound.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? With 2 pounds of flunkin hanging off his face. And just the cutest, funniest, warmest, sweetest, hilarious deadpan.
And just a look. He can get a laugh with just a look. Just a look.
So that informs everything that I've ever done is – you want to say it with a look.
Yeah.
You want to say it. Good writing is saying it without saying it. The best writing is some guy's face.
That scene in the Odd Couple of movie where he throws the spaghetti against the wall and goes,
No, it's garbage.
And just like, Felix! Like, Grumpy Old Men is most recent thing that people might remember him from if you haven't seen that. Yeah. Yeah.
Seeing not a great movie, but he's great.
What was it about Sid Caesar that and this is called a show of shows for those of you listening. And this was a precursor to Saturday Night Live, if you will. And he was the star and they did these amazing sketches. You ever see the one where he's getting dressed as like a general, but then the payoff is complete. You ever see it?
Of course.
Oh, it's so great. It's so,
so there's good. there's a movie, if you just want a quick course in Sid Caesar, there's a movie called 10 from your show of shows. The name of the show was the Saturday Night Live. It literally was Saturday Night Live, an hour and a half, called Your Show of Shows.
Right.
And this is 10 from your show of shows. And it's the 10 best sketches from that series. It ends with what is widely considered the funniest sketch of all time, a parody of This Is Your Life called This Is Your Story. And I don't want to ruin it for you. I think you can go on YouTube right now and look up Sid Caesar, This Is Your Story. And just watch that sketch. It features another character played by Howie Morris called Uncle Goopy.
Yeah, oh, Howie Morris was so good.
Do you remember this sketch? Did you ever see
it? I do remember it, yeah. And I remember how it – I don't want to say anything. People need to go just Google it.
I think that's right. Let's not oversell it. Let's not talk. But it's not overselling it to say it's the funniest sketch of all time.
And then the is the one about the silent movie star included in that where he finally talks?
There's he has a very high voice.
but he looks like Clark Gable and then he starts to talk and it just
Sid Caesar was the was a genius because he could imitate any dialect and he was just naturally hysterically funny. He was so funny that he attracted the best comedy writers in the history of the world.
Right.
Mel Brooks, Woody Allen, Larry Gelbart, who went on to the right, MASH. MASH and Tootsie, Neil Simon, you've heard of him.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, so many, Mel Tolkien, a murderer's row of comedy writers, all writing for this guy, super talent.
Yeah. He Mel Brooks tells great stories about him, and he was very, very strong, Sid, and he had a temper. And he would, you know, he would like... They were killing themselves, so they would use like greenies or amphetamines. They were using pills like just to kind of stay awake, or whatever. They were crossing a street one day in New York, and this cab driver is just laying on the horn, and Sid snaps and walks over, and he literally, this was like before people wore their seatbelts, right? The guy, it was like a warm day, so the guy's window was open. He literally, with one hand, pulled the guy through the window and beat him on the street and walked away.
There's a, the, you left out one thing.
Yeah.
There's a line before he pulled the guy through the little side window, the little triangle window.
That
you could crack open a little bit and it have. So he started to pull him out through there. He goes, "You remember your birth?"
Oh, that's great. I didn't know that part. That's so great.
Neil Simon tells the stories where they're walking in Manhattan. You know, they filmed at the, what's now, is it Civic Center? What's the beautiful theater on 55th Street? That's where they shot your show of shows.
Not the Ed Sullivan Theater.
No. 55th Street.
Yeah, I can't remember what it
was. And 6th or 6th and 7th. Anyway, they're walking down the street. Neil Simon's very, very quiet guy. He's very shy. And he's walking with Mel, who's the opposite.
Yeah.
And he looks and coming walking towards them are two nuns in the habits. And Neil just says to himself, "Oh no, oh no, please." And what is he going to do? What is he going to do? And they pass them. And Mel says, "We cut that sketch."
Oh my God. Can you imagine living in that time? Oh my God. Oh my God.
I've gotten to know. Beautiful, these guys. You know, Carl Reiner, I didn't even mention. He worked on the show, too.
Yeah, well, he was really good along with Sid. They would do that that foreign language gibberish, which sounded legitimate, but it wasn't. They do German, French. They were fantastic at it.
So I'm friendly with Carl. I go to see him every couple of weeks. We have lunch. And I love him. And all these guys. I've been with them together at dinner.
We're losing one by one.
But I went to lunch with Larry Gelbart and Norman Lear, and they're asking me what it's like now to pitch a show at a network. And I start to tell them what you go through. And Larry turns to Norman. He says, "We're dying just in time."
You should I had Norman Lear on my show, and he was fantastic, and he has great stories. And he tells a story at the height of All in the Family. They had like a 60 million viewers, and they had a show, a special show that got even more viewers.
Yeah.
And whenever the commercial came on, it changed the water. It affected the water table in New York because everybody was going to the bathroom to flush the toilet. And it's good that that stuff is still around, though, for people to, you know, experience and hear a lot of their work. You know, Blazing Saddles still holds up, obviously. You know,
Young Frankenstein.
Oh God, it's unbelievable. There were two people that you worked with, Peter O'Toole and Robert Mitchum, which I thought was fascinating. You created a show for Peter O'Toole?
Two of them.
Wow. What was he like? What was he like to work with? What were the concepts of the shows?
I heard in 1994 that he wanted to do a sitcom. He had worked. I don't know how much time we have. Are we good?
Yeah, we're good. I mean, keep going. If you're good, we're good.
Couple minutes.
Yeah.
So, he had he did a movie with John Goodman, who was starring in Roseanne at the time. And during the film in this movie, John Goodman told him about how much money could be made in sitcoms. And suddenly Peter O'Toole wanted to do a sitcom. And so we got a call. Would you be interested in doing a sitcom for him? And I'm like, what?
Yeah. Yeah.
I would be willing to do whatever Peter O'Toole wants me to do.
Yeah.
And so we write it, and we get three or four pages of notes from Peter O'Toole. We haven't been introduced, nothing. He says he likes it. He has notes. Paul, I want to tell you, the best notes I ever received on anything before or since.
Really? Well, very thorough, very on point, all legitimate.
Like notes that you dream of getting that only make your stuff better while kind of boosting you up.
Well, here's a guy that worked with the likes of David Lean, a great storyteller. Yep. So if anybody knows how to tell a story, it's him.
No. This guy, I mean, beyond actor. If you get a chance to read his autobiographies, I think they're in two or three volumes.
Mm-hmm.
So entertaining. If you ever got lucky enough to see him on a talk show, Rock on Tour, definition of the word.
Mm-hmm.
Go take a look at him on YouTube. And watch him tell a story.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I'm telling you, a gift to the world would be this guy sitting in a chair and just speaking about whatever he wants to speak about.
Right.
So we do the notes. We send them back. He says, gentlemen, he calls us on the phone. Gentlemen, I'm in.
Wow.
But I think we should meet. Why don't we meet halfway? You're in Los Angeles. I'm in London. Shall we meet in New York?
Oh, wow.
We meet in New York. I spend a day with Peter O'Toole in New York. It's like my favorite year in a day.
Oh, that's awesome.
We have lunch at the Oak Bar.
Mm-hmm.
We go to a deli. And you're walking down the street with friggin' Peter O'Toole with his scarf blowing back on Fifth Avenue and cab drivers going, hey, Peter O'Toole, fucking Peter O'Toole.
That's awesome.
Right. Hello, sir. Hello, gentlemen. Gentlemen, my lady. You know, he's like, he liked being Peter O'Toole. Okay, so this is going. NBC. Here we go. We start casting. My phone rings in my house. In my house. I don't know how this man got my number, but it's Judd Hirsch.
Wow.
Judd Hirsch is calling me. Why are you calling me, Judd Hirsch? I heard you doing a show with Peter O'Toole. Yes, that's true. I want to be in it.
Oh, my God.
I said, well, the we have a part that maybe you're right for. It doesn't matter. Just I'm in. I want to do it. Right?
Right.
We start casting the son. We cast the son. We found a kid. We found a kid who became David Krumholtz, who went on to do many things in television and stuff. But we had him as Peter O'Toole's nerdy grandson who really needed Peter O'Toole in his life to help him out. Right?
Mm.
We start to cast the wife. We get a call from NBC. Listen, the head of NBC would rather not have someone with an accent on the network. So the show is dead.
Are you kidding me?
I am not kidding you.
Oh my
We're dying
God.
Just in time, Paul.
Oh my God, that's so depressing. Hey, you know, you worked, they worked for you, but my friends, Mike Royce, John Manfredi, on Raymond, you get, now Ray Race, a friend of mine too. And I was, is this true that like,
him I don't like.
You don't like him, Ray Romano. Well, the story is that you're the reason you guys, I think Rory Rosegarten, his manager, told me that they were like really, they were having trouble finding somebody that clicked with Ray and got it. And then they were like, you were one of the last guys they were going to see that day or that week. And you came in and it was like, you're the Jewish version of Ray, or he's the Italian version of you, with similar family situations, dynamics, and you guys just hit it off, apparently. Is that true? I was always curious about that.
I think it's true. I also think they couldn't get anybody else.
No, stop.
No, I mean, I didn't have credits. I never created a show before. I was a writer. The last thing I worked on was coach for some, which was for somebody else, but I never ran a show.
I think that would have been a much harder sell today to have you and Ray was, you know, Ray wasn't a huge star, obviously. No. So it's like, you know, that, but thank God, you know what I mean? Like otherwise wouldn't it's a, did you guys have people come in after their weekend and tell stories about their life or anything funny that happened that possibly to use as fodder to get ideas?
That's all we did.
That's unbelievable.
Every single show. I would say 90% of every episode, we did 210 episodes.
We're talking about Everybody Loves Raymond for those listening. Yes. Great show. Everybody Loves Raymond. But go ahead. Sorry.
90% of everything you saw happen to me or to Ray or to one of the other writers. If you worked for me, your job was to go home, get in a fight with your wife, come back in and tell me about it. That's the show. We didn't, when we came into work, this is how stupid we were. We did it 9 years. Yeah. Every day, it's like we had this expression, the monkey never learns. Right? Shit over and over again. You never learn. Right. You come in the morning, another work day, blah, blah, blah. You're like, we're complaining. We're having beautiful breakfast. We're eating. We're having coffee. We're laughing. We're talking about stupid things that happen at home, things that happen. And invariably, around lunchtime, somebody says, hey, wait a minute. That could be an episode. That's how it went. Completely, we fell into it unintentionally every episode.
What was the biggest adjustment from you going from writing, staff writing, to show running? And for those of you who don't know what show running is, when you see the names on the screen after the show, executive producer, one of those people is the showrunner, and they literally oversee the running of the show and making sure that the writing's getting done and make the decisions about the writing and all of that. And what was the biggest, hardest adjustment? Because I've done that job too, and I've had my own adjustments, but like, what did you have to kind of get better at in order to do that job well?
Well, we all know the moment you write a script and it's, and you're a writer, you could be a lonely hermit. You could be antisocial. You could sit in your room and write a script, but the moment they buy it and you're going to make a pilot, suddenly you're kind of running the show.
Yeah.
And if you, and then if the show is picked up, and they let you run the show, suddenly you're in charge of a company. There's 150 people working for you, and there's millions of dollars at stake. That's not an exaggeration.
Right.
This is now something worth millions of dollars, and you never drove the car before.
Right.
That's the biggest adjustment.
Yeah.
It goes down to what's your personality going to be like?
Mm. What kind of manager are you going to be?
Exactly. Are you going to be tough? And mean, or are you going to be nice? Are you going to, what are you going to be?
Yeah.
Well, tough and mean was never going to be an option for me because look at me.
Yeah, but you have
my kids go to bed, they laugh.
You go to bed, you're going to bed early. Yeah, right, Dad, whatever.
He's funny. And so I thought, be nice. And I'll tell you the truth, and this ties in very nicely to what I'm doing now. I thought the best way to show love to people, to create a family off stage as well as on stage, was having good food on the set.
Yeah, I tell
it's
you.
Essential. The army travels on its stomach. If you go to craft service and it's just junk, like we were talking about, you know, M&Ms and crap, you know, they grab it. They're happy to grab it, but they go away and they don't feel very good after.
Well, they don't. I don't think they feel good physically, but more important, emotionally. I think it sends a signal that you just don't give a shit about them really, and they're just workers. But if you go to the trouble of taking care of them, those people are going to go an extra mile for you, I believe.
You hit it on the head. That is exactly what we did. Mm. We had friggin' like cinnamon buns flown in from Chicago. Ann Sather's. Mm. I don't know if you ever heard.
Yeah,
of it.
Yeah, I love cinnamon bun. I mean, that's
we had New York deli flown in once in a while. Well, once a year we brought in stone crab claws from Florida.
Oh wow!
Got hammers from the set and spread newspaper on the table. Went to town. we had beautiful food trucks backstage every shoot night. We had a wonderful craft service guy who would make you fresh soups and sandwiches every mm-hmm. day. Every time you went back to that table, it was some other delight that was like, I love it here. We're in fairyland. And God damn it, everybody stayed. It engenders loyalty. It engenders good work even.
Yeah,
it makes a happy place.
Absolutely.
Food.
So do you cook? I read that your mother wasn't a great cook, which is that true? And that surprises me because I just assume like Italians, all Jewish mothers are good cooks. But yes or no?
You assume wrong. No, not everyone is blessed. No. But yeah, I'll tell you this. I meet a lot of chefs, great chefs, like people like Alice Waters. They say their mother couldn't cook. And it wasn't until Alice Waters, the queen of, you know, the founder of the way we eat today, mm-hmm. right? The farm to table, the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
She had an epiphany on her first trip to Europe, like I did. She went to Paris and France and her head exploded. With the freshness and the flavor and and it changed. She came back to California. She came back, opened Chez Panisse in Berkeley, California, and changed America.
Hmm.
Yes.
But why does it take someone to go to Europe to figure out people are going to want fresh, nice food that it doesn't have a lot of ungapach, you know? Like what? Right. Well,
you know, who got it later than us even? England.
But,
London.
But why? London. Can you explain why people...
The worst food in the world. Because they had a war mentality from World War II. The vegetables stayed in the cans, right?
Yeah.
They didn't have fresh anything. And now London's one of the best places to eat.
Yeah. Now, do you cook for your kids? You cook for your family? Are you a cook?
No, I love them too much. I don't. I listen. We don't all have to be good at everything, right? Exactly. I meet a lot of great chefs. They can't write a sitcom.
Exactly. Now, do you...
So I'm a perfect audience. They watch my show and laugh. I eat their food and go,
Yeah. Do you...
I'm a good audience for them.
Do you travel with your kids? Do you take them on some of these adventures?
Yes. Even when they were little.
That's great.
I want them to have this. I want them. And by the way, we mentioned Venice. Mm. Perfect place to take the little ones. To take a three-year-old.
Why?
You're in a boat.
Yeah.
They like it.
Yeah.
They like it. It's and they'll walk anywhere as long as it's ending in pizza or gelato.
That's right.
And by the way, if you're with me, that's usually where it's ending.
Oh, that's great. So now, you shot all the episodes for this season, correct?
Yep.
And assuming you go to the next season, which I'm sure you will because it's so funny. And you're so funny in it. I love you when you're standing in the river with that ridiculous hat on and you go... Are there snakes in this river? And the guy's in jeans and a polo shirt and he's up to his waist in water. And he goes, yeah. And he just goes right back to work. And you do a double take to the camera. It was so great. It's so great.
Oh my God. It's some things are scary. But look, it's all about just taking baby steps out of your comfort zone.
Yeah.
That step, that was a big step.
Yeah.
I admit. Yeah. That was a big step. But I'll tell you, I'm so glad I did it. You watched that episode of Saigon?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it was a magical thing that happened there.
You could feel it as a viewer, like you were sort of, it was turning into something that even you didn't expect. You could feel it as you're watching it.
I cry thinking about it.
Yeah. Yeah. So you have plans to do another round. You already have places you think you want to go if you're doing another season and all of that.
I only want to do this the rest of my life.
Wow. I tell you, you got it great, man. You found another, you know, it's not often that somebody is so successful in one area of the arts and then sort of finds another genre that's so right for them. And you're on camera. Good for you. I'm sure that's fulfilling too. I think it's really terrific. It's really funny and you're really funny. And
thank you.
First...
I love every aspect of the business, writing, performing, directing, editing, producing. I love every aspect of the business except the business.
Yeah, I know. You know, Leno said to me one time, he goes, I don't get paid all this money to do what I do on stage. I do that for free. It's to put up with all the, you know, BS off stage. And there's something to that. Yeah. Now, are you involved do you give notes on the final edit and all of that stuff too in the show? Or do you leave that to them and sort of?
I got to be honest. It's my show. I do it.
Good.
I have to.
Yeah.
It has to. You have to have some vision behind the thing. Mm-hmm. Every great show of any kind has a point of view.
Right.
And you can't have that if you're sharing it with everybody. No. Yes, you want everyone's input, but at the end of the day, it all has to be filtered through the one head so that there's a unity of tone and purpose and vision. Right.
And would you and Ray usually pretty much agree on things? I mean, I assumed it was a shared responsibility in that regard. And were you pretty much simpatico most of the time on things? I would imagine you were if you lasted 9 years.
I think, you know, we reached a point where, yes, we knew what the show was, but of course it had that birthing pain. You know, you're asking me some questions about procedure and how we did it. And I'm not here to sell you a book, but I wrote a book about this very thing, about turning your actual life into something useful. We all think our lives aren't worth anything. Who wants to hear about this?
What's the book? Tell them the title.
It's called You're Lucky, You're Funny, How Life Becomes a Sitcom. Mm-hmm. And I recommend the audio download. It's kind of like having me in the car with you for 7 hours, but it has good sound bites taken from live things that we did. And so it's a little more entertaining than just reading.
I want to read this quote of yours about writing, which I think everybody should get, regardless if you're writing or not, and whether you're writing comedy, drama. And it says, write very, very specifically and true to what you experienced. That's the way to hit everyone. All of our lives deal in specifics. So even if your specific isn't my specific, you understand the specificness itself. I thought that was so well put, because that's what you have to do as a comedian. You know, when you start out as a stand-up, you kind of just do general jokes and you're scared shitless and you just don't want to bomb. So your jokes are kind of more what I call surface jokes about, you know, about Coca-Cola and going through the drive-thru at McDonald's. But then once you move beyond that and you get comfortable in your own skin up there, you really want to start talking about what makes you you and what makes you tick. And then you find your quote-unquote audience, because they are like-minded, and that's your audience and that's your army that you build. So I really related to that and thought it was a really great way of putting what good writing is. Was that hard for you to get to that place, to talk about very specific things that were personal to you?
Stumbled on it by accident. I didn't know. Here I am. They chose me to create this pilot for Ray Romano. I go home. I learn about his family life, his actual family life. And what I don't know about his life, I'm filling in with the personalities from my life. Right. And so I told a story. I get to a point in the script I'm writing. I got to show how crazy this, the first scene with the parents. I got to show how crazy Ray's parents are. And I remember this story of giving my parents a Fruit of the Month Club and how it exploded in my face, because my mother couldn't believe that every month more fruit was going to come to the house. And there was so much. I can't talk anymore. There's too much fruit in the house. And so I did that scene. And don't you know that that's the scene everybody says put us over, got us on the air.
Wow.
It was very specific.
Yeah.
It was about a very specific thing. I didn't realize that it was universal. I didn't realize, thank God, your parents are crazy too. And not just crazy. I get letters still from people. I gave my parents Fruit of the Month, the same thing.
That's great. Yeah. Yeah, I talk about that stuff in my act.
The Indian family, right? Where the mother's trying to set up the son on date after date, right?
Right.
And it's very specific to the Indian way of life. Every single person on earth relates to this.
Yeah. It's so great. I mean, and your enthusiasm just across the board, and, you know, about your show that you're doing now and what you've done. And I just think it's fantastic. I could talk to you all day. We got to do another one of these. You got to come on again and we got to talk some more.
Coming to New York this week. I'm coming tomorrow. I'll be there for a week.
Okay.
When I come, well, if you want to eat, I love to eat.
Yes.
You seem like a nice fella. I want to do the TV show. I want to do it because it's my favorite. I'm telling you, it's my favorite.
Yeah. Well, I think it would be great.
That's helped me through my life.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a crazy life right now. You know, it's funny when you were talking about, like, the show has to have one voice and a head. You know, the Daily Show, I worked on the Daily Show and it was Liz Winstead. And then after Liz, and it was, you know, her and Madeline Smithberg shared that voice and that was specific. But then John Stewart came on board and then it went through John, and, you know, became great because John, you know, focused our comedy toward politics and the media's coverage of politics for the most part. But it's so true. And I'm always shocked when they try to cast a show in terms of the behind the scenes producers and have it run by committee, because it never works. And the reason that show worked, The Daily Show, much like Raymond, was that it was a very specific point of view coming from one or two people in your case. And that was it. And so at the end of the day, it had to pass through that filter. And that's what made it great. That's what made it great.
Thanks. I mean, I was lucky to have Ray as a collaborator, because he really is truly a great writer besides being a great actor and naturally super funny.
Yeah.
So I got really, really lucky.
Well, he got lucky too. That's where I think you bringing everything that you brought to the table plus your writing chops, I think it was a great marriage, obviously. But now you've got this show, and I'm hoping the show goes forever and ever. And there's certainly not a lack of places you can go and food you can eat. So everybody needs to go watch the Netflix show, Somebody Feed Phil, and make sure you tell your friends about it. And it's really terrific. And if you enough of you watch it, Phil will come to your house and cook for you. Right, Phil? Isn't that what you said earlier?
Sure. Because I don't love them as much as my family.
All right. Well, listen, I'll see you when you come to New York. We're going to get together and hang out. And good luck with the show. I'm sure it's going to go bonkers. And I'm looking forward to another season. And I think it's going to be great. I think you're great in it. I think you bring – I love the part where you bring your parents into it and you Skype with them, and it's just so
they're the real stars. People tell me they like the show. They love my parents. I'm like, why do I bother flying anywhere?
How did you come up with that idea to bring them into it? Was it just, again, like a happenstance thing? It just happened one time?
Or? No, I did a documentary called Exporting Raymond. Mm-hmm. That's on Netflix too, by the way. It's about, I took a camera crew with me to Russia.
Right.
Russia asked me to turn Raymond into Everybody Loves Kostya. So I thought I'd document the whole thing and see what we get. And we got something, I think, crazy and funny.
Yeah.
And I Skyped with my parents from there. And that was the hit of the movie. Mm. And so I'm not crazy. I remember that.
Yeah.
And I thought, look, when you travel, the Skype with the family is the new postcard home.
That's a great way of putting it. Yep. Absolutely.
And so I could kill a lot of birds with that stone. Yeah. And damn, if every time I don't turn that thing on, they deliver. They're like, I don't know what they are. They're like great comic character actors. I don't know why. They don't even know.
Yeah, I know. That's the thing. They don't know.
So promo coming out. It might be on before this even airs. That Netflix flew a crew out to film them in a promo.
Wow.
I said, what about me?
just film yourself on your phone. You'll be fine, Phil. All right. Well, the show is Somebody Feed Phil. It's on Netflix. Go watch it and pick up his book. You're lucky you're funny. And listen to it in the car, because Phil's a great guy to have with you as you're driving for 7 hours. And I'm gonna see you when you come to New York. Thanks for being on the show. This was fantastic. And good luck with the show.
Paul, you're terrific. Thank you so much.
All right. That was Phil Rosenthal. How funny is he? I'm going to do another show with him, because he's just, I mean, we're kindred spirits, man. We love the same stuff, and he's a real foodie. He's invested in over 20 restaurants. How crazy is that? They're all Subways, but hey, you know, they're restaurants. No, I'm just kidding. Really, really cool high-end restaurants. All right, February 23rd and 24th. Hope to see you guys at Gotham Comedy Club in New York City. February 23rd, 24th. Thanks for tuning in, and catch up with us next week.